It's very hard to sum up the literary legacy of a figure as towering as American author Toni Morrison. As you know, she died recently at 88, and I promised we would mark her passing with an in-depth discussion of her life and work. Toni Morrison wrote for Black America. She says she wrote because no one else was writing for her world. Although, as it turns out, I think she was writing for all of us. Here she is speaking about the language of her writing in 1998.
I like the tactile, the sensual, the highly visual. And the problem is trying to not say so much that you close the reader out. So if you can say just enough so that the reader can enter into the picture or into the situation and feel his or her own sensuality or his or her own dream life, then that's the success. There's a lot of restraint in the language in order to be provocative.
Not only did Toni Morrison vividly capture the lives of Black Americans, she found a way to do so that was incandescent and imaginative, drawing on history, mythology, and mysticism. By the time Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993, she had written 6 novels and would go on to write 11 in total, along with books for children and essay collections. She also had started in publishing as an editor. I'm joined by 2 writers who've been thinking about Toni Morrison's legacy. Sasonke Msamung is based in Perth. She's the author of 2 non-fiction books and she's the new director of Perth Writers Festival. Welcome, Sasonke.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
And Rebecca Carroll is author of a number of non-fiction works, including a study of Black American women writers. Rebecca is also a radio producer from New York. Hello to you, Rebecca.
Hello.
Rebecca, Toni Morrison is considered one of the most important voices in literature in the 20th century. But what was it about her writing that pierced the heart of America?
Well, you know, she really moves through you. She crafts words and sentences and rhythms of vernacular that sort of move through you, sometimes like a fluid spiritual and other times like a rock that you swallowed, heavy and sharp in your belly. Until it's sort of forced to disintegrate because it won't leave your body. You can't expel it. She just knew how to do that in a way that felt kind of otherworldly.
Sasonke, how would you sum up that writing and her
legacy?
I can't
top Rebecca's description. I mean, she's put into words what you feel when you open a Toni Morrison book. I mean, one of the things about any book by Toni Morrison is you can literally open it to any page and be pulled in simply by the writing. So in terms of craft, there is just nobody who gets anywhere near her. There is something incredibly poetic about her prose, but as she says in her own description of her work, there is not a word out of place. So every word has been thought through, right? It's there for meaning. If there's a double entendre, sometimes as a writer, you write something and you don't mean it to mean what it does to the writer. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about, to the reader, that's one of the wonderful things about writing. You never get that sense with Toni Morrison. If you're thinking it, she intended you to think it.
Exactly.
Well, Rebecca, Toni Morrison says she wrote her debut novel, The Bluest Eye, because no one else was writing stories that spoke to her world in that way. What was so distinctive about this book and the time it came out in 1970?
Well, I think what's really critically important about the book that often gets overlooked is that, you know, it wasn't necessarily her world. She was very, very much proud and Black and self-confident in the family that she grew up in and in her own world. But she was able to create a space where this young Black girl was interfacing with the white gaze and was then coming into that world and not prepared to be kind to herself, to formulate herself, to individuate herself. And it's almost as if Morrison, you know, created this girl to give her the tools that she had herself. Mm. And so I think that really kind of pierced Black America in a way where, you know, you could identify with the narrators and you could identify with this girl who you just wanted to sort of take into your arms and into your life and help her to see the beauty of her Blackness.
Did Toni Morrison want us to pity her, though?
No, I don't believe she did at all. I think that what she created Pecola to illustrate the damage of the white gaze, which Morrison was very, very cognizant of keeping out of her work. Mm. She was very clear-minded and cognizant of the damage that could do. And I think that there's this sort of rallying around Pecola in a very sort of black but also humanistic way, and she wasn't able to take it in. And that, I think, without even, you know, sort of, that's masterful, right? To write about the white gaze without writing about the white gaze.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Lots of nodding there from Sasanke. How do you respond?
Yeah, I just couldn't agree more with what Rebecca's just said. That Toni Morrison never allowed for a sense that the writer ought to be pitied. Mm. You know, she didn't write as a black woman who felt bad about the white gaze and how it operated on her. She was totally above that. And so she wrote from a place always of being able to observe it, of being able to dissect it, of being able to show its horror, but certainly never as someone who was wounded and damaged by it herself, which is a pretty remarkable thing given how pervasive we know that is. And as Rebecca said, her life's work wrote against it without also at the same time giving it any power.
Rebecca, this was the first book you'd read of Toni Morrison. It had a big impact.
Mm-hmm. It had a huge impact. I mean, I'm not the first black adoptee raised by white parents to reflect on how sort of betrayed I felt when I discovered Toni Morrison and other black literature. But I think that what was so important and is so important to emphasize both to white parents of black children and really everyone is that Morrison made worlds for us, and that we are the children of our white adopted parents, but we are also children of those black worlds that Morrison made for us. And so I found myself so drawn to the language, and obviously, as I wrote about in my Atlantic piece, I related to Pecola on a very visceral level because I was surrounded by the white gaze. I was surrounded by the bluest eyes. I was, you know, trying fervently to create an identity without really anywhere to look except for books.
Rebecca, can you read from The Bluest Eye so that we get a taste of this work?
Sure. Each night, without fail, she prayed for blue eyes. Fervently, for a year, she had prayed. Although somewhat discouraged, she was not without hope. To have something as wonderful as that happen would take a long, long time. Thrown in this way into the binding convictions that only a miracle could relieve her, she would never know her beauty. She would see only what there was to see, the eyes of other people. She walks down Garden Avenue to a small grocery store which sells penny candy. 3 pennies are in her shoe, slipping back and forth between the sock and the inner sole. With each step, she feels the pain press of the coins against her foot. A sweet and durable, even cherished irritation, full of promise and delicate security. There is plenty of time to consider what to buy. Now, however, she moves down an avenue, gently buffeted by the familiar and therefore loved images, the dandelions at the base of the telephone pole. Why, she wonders, do people call them weeds? She thought they were pretty. But grown-ups say, Miss Dunyan keeps her yard so nice, not a dandelion anywhere. Hunky woman in black babushkas go into the fields with baskets to pull them up, but they do not want the yellow heads, only the jagged leaves. They make dandelion soup, dandelion wine. Nobody loves the head of a dandelion, maybe because they are so many, strong and soon.
Rebecca Carroll reading from The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. Sasanke, reading The Bluest Eye, I can see how Toni Morrison's style developed in the books that followed, from Sulla to Song of Solomon, Tar Baby, and really coalesced in Beloved and Jazz. There's this polyphonic narrative with the echoes of history and slavery ever present. How did Toni Morrison's writerly voice develop over time?
It's interesting because I think Toni Morrison's, as her writerly voice developed, in many ways, the society around her responded to her. You know, she was a a literary force, of course, as we could clearly hear in that reading by Rebecca, but she was also such a cultural force. And I think it's very difficult to pull those two things apart. So she was, from the first novel, incredibly confident. She was so self-confident and not self-conscious at all about her gifts and her talents and her skill, the skill and the thought that she put into everything that she wrote. And that only, of course, grew over time. She tackled, you know, what she described as historical fiction. She read deeply. She thought about how to affix her imagination on the worlds that Black Americans had created for themselves and the world that had been thrust upon them. And she just did that with increasing... It was just sort of layers and layers of more confidence and more grace and more depth. But she was, in some ways, I feel like she was fully formed when she came out of the gate.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to improve on The Bluest Eye, which is such a powerful and incredible novel. And then you keep reading and you go, oh my goodness, the power that is here, that spooling and unspooling of history in her work.
In some ways, I think... Maybe it's the wrong frame to think about her as a writer who gets better. I think it's more interesting to think about the breadth of her work, because the depth is always there.
I think she would probably agree with you, Sasanka. And I think she would say, I'm not writing to get better. If I do get better, that's wonderful. But she had such pleasure with language, such pleasure in her freedom to do that. You know, she talked about language, she talked about mothering, right? These are the things that she took such pleasure in, and you could feel that in the language.
And Sasanke, you've chosen a reading from Toni Morrison's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Beloved. Could you share it with us?
Sure. Seeth, if I'm here with you, with Denver, you can go anywhere you want. Jump if you want to, because I'll catch you, girl. I'll catch you before you fall. Go as far inside as you need to. I'll hold your ankles. Make sure you get back out. I'm not saying this because I need a place to stay. That's the last thing I need. I told you, I'm a walking man. But I've been heading in this direction for 7 years, walking all around this place, upstate, downstate, east, west. I've been in territory, ain't got no name, never staying nowhere long. But when I got here and I sat out there on that porch waiting for you, well... I knew it wasn't the place I was heading towards. It was you. We can make a life, girl. A life.
Thank you for that reading, Sasanka.
That's beautiful.
Isn't it?
And of course, Beloved is perhaps one of her most well-known novels, and this is the novel that explores the impact of slavery, because it's about a woman who escapes slavery, and to make sure her children don't have this affliction, she murders one of them.
A real person. A real person,
that's
Margaret
right.
Garner.
That's right. It was based on a real person. But Sasanke, why did you choose this section? It's the voice of a man.
Because, as Rebecca just said, so much of Toni Morrison's work is about the pleasure of being alive. She is always deeply sensual, as she describes the relationship between women and children, between friends, and certainly the way she describes the relationships between men and women. And coming from a community that is so often caricatured, so often the subject of pathologies, one of the things that is absolutely beautiful and always so sure-footed about Toni Morrison's descriptions of relationships between Black men and Black women is the love. And even when those are difficult relationships, you never get a sense that that difficulty came out of nowhere. There is such a complexity and richness. There are no horrible bad guys. They are often incredibly beautiful good guys. And Paul D is certainly one of them.
What you're saying there is also that the readers of Toni Morrison aren't just women. They're men too.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody read Toni Morrison. Her status, you know, in sort of the literary world was such that you'd have to be actively trying to avoid her. And of course, there were people who did that, but I think everyone read her. But she was very clear that although she wrote for herself and for her community in an intellectual sense, her her readers were everyone, and she wanted her readers to be everyone. And I think, you know, one of the things that I reflected on in the weeks since her passing was how many of those wonderful tributes have been by women and by Black women. We sort of circled her and we mourned her and we grieved her and we praised her. But we also, I think that I'm interested and keen to see how others will do the same for her, because she belonged to the world.
Finally, what book would you recommend to a reader who hasn't read Toni Morrison?
That's so hard. Goodness. I mean, each one is so uniquely beautiful and learns a lesson. My personal favorite is Sula.
That's her second novel.
Because of the friendship and the flaws and the womanness and the kinship, and that's my favorite. So I guess I would recommend Sula.
What about you, Sasanka?
I would recommend Song of Solomon for all the same reasons that Rebecca recommends Sula. The kinship, the absolute terror of being too much in love, because I love the male characters, because Milkman Dead, because slaves could fly. All of those reasons are
because
why I love
guitar.
Song of Solomon. Because guitar. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show to drill down just a little bit more into what made Toni Morrison's writing so special and celebrated. Sasanke Msimang's latest book is The Resurrection of Winnie Mandela, and Rebecca Carroll's upcoming memoir is called Surviving the White Gaze. Thank you to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Sarah.
I'm Sarah Lestrange, and this is The Book Show. Let's end with words from Toni Morrison about happy endings.
The happy, happy endings that exist in all my books, which some people doubt because people drop dead all the time. And, you know, they keep saying, why? What happened? But for me, it's the epiphanies. It's the fact that they know something at the end of the novel that they didn't know at the beginning. And the possibility for fulfillment or imagination or some grand solution to a question that they have exists. And that for me is what I call upbeat and optimistic, not whether they live forever or even live.
The late, great Toni Morrison, who didn't live forever, but taught us all something we didn't know before.